Leo Perry, in just one second, we'll talk about the proceedings of the last meeting and something about public hearings. But while you're coming in, I was asked by several members to clarify this whole matter of these little ballots, you know, like for the selection committee. So you've got these little name cards and you put them in the ballot box. You should do that by 5 o'clock today, okay? So if you want to take a chance in being drawn as a member of that committee, you should do it by 5 o'clock today. The other question was asked, when will it meet? We're saying sometime in July, probably, in all probability, the second week of July. That's the 11th, 12th, or something like that. The 12th. The second week of July is what we're going to try for. So if you know absolutely that you can't do it the second week of July, so it's that week, but we will poll the members, okay, just to make sure that there is maybe another day that might be better. But we're going to think about the 12th of July. And then the third question asked, what if when someone drops out, we will keep the cards, just like we kept the cards for you guys. You know, when you went to these selection meetings, we'll keep the cards. And if anyone drops out, then we'll do another random draw out of the hat. Are you ready then? Leo.
Thanks, Jack. I think you've all received the little memos this morning that we completed late yesterday afternoon, giving you the location that you ended up being assigned or allocated. I just want to kind of go through the process so you understand what kind of magic occurs after you submit forms to the office. We had to make some decisions because there was a lot of conflict. And what I have on the screen is just one of the cells or locations. This is for Abbotsford, and it's just to give you an example. The yellow means that that's a person in a neighboring district. The purple or the pink is just a code for a person in where you might have a short-haul trip. So I have some sense of expenditures that I'm controlling as well. The green refers to a long-haul trip. And the blue refers to a local person. So when we received all of the requests, we just kind of put them on this table and kind of coded them all so we could just kind of keep track of how many locals we had, how many neighbors we had, how many short-haul interests or preferences we had, and how many long-haul preferences we had. So you just kind of have to keep this in mind because in some of the cells, we had lots of green, which is all long haul. And when you talk about the Queen Charlotte's, you can't get there without spending a fair amount of money. So everything had green on it, despite the fact there could have been one who was local, that is a member of the North Coast District, and one who was a neighbor, that is neighbor to the North Coast District, which is still a demarcation that goes down through one of the straits. And so we had to find some processes in which we handle all of these decisions. Some of the criteria that we used, clearly we thought that your local selection should be respected. So request for attendance in your local district was given a priority. Request for attendance in a neighboring district was also given a priority. Request for attendance in a neighboring district where you didn't happen to have a meeting in your own electoral district, which could happen in the Lower Mainland. Of course, that was given a high priority. And then requests for attendance at a hearing that was at least 500 kilometers away, provided you were kind of going into a different setting. Sending someone from Fort Nelson to Sparwood didn't seem to indicate much change in environment, despite the fact that you were going south. And there would be changes. No doubt that each community is unique in the province, but we were more interested in taking somebody from the northeast and sending them down to the Lower Mainland or into the island, or taking people from the interior and putting them on the coast, taking that kind of an approach to sending or making these decisions. We also had some limits because when we went from 42 hearings to the 49, we had to make some limits in terms of the number of people that we could support going to any one location. Because had we granted all of the requests for the Queen Charlotte's, we'd have sent 22 people or something in that number. And most of them would have flown there at one time or another from Vancouver. One of the things we did as we were grappling with this is we tried to respect the first choice that people had made. And so we went down the list and kind of said, okay, for first choice, we would deal with that. And I just want to flip ahead to the Queen Charlotte's here. So there's Queen Charlotte City, and you can see that there's a lot of interest in the Queen Charlotte's, but there's a fair number of people in there that had a first choice was the Queen Charlotte's. We had more than we wanted to send who had first choice for the Queen Charlotte. So what we did is we followed the tradition that started with the selection process, and we used the hat that we have. And so we put all of the ones, and so we had enough choice by gender there, so we put all of the female names in the hat, and we drew one name. And then we put all of the male number ones in the hat and drew one name. And because we were looking at possibly sending three people plus the local and the neighbor to this meeting, we put all of the names in and gave everybody an equal chance to be selected. And then we pulled another name out. So out of that process, there's three of you plus Linda Fantillo and Margaret Anderson who will be going to the Queen Charlotte's, and I can't remember who was selected. We went through this kind of a process for each location because there were places where we had to make choices and we had to pull names out of the hat and so on. We worked our way through all of these communities, and I had then went back through and I recorded all of the locations against names. And so sometimes I would end up with an individual who had given us lots of choices, and because there was no competition to go to a particular location, you know, they might have three or four recorded names against, or three or four locations, and some of them had up to six locations recorded against their name that was not in conflict. And so we wanted to kind of hold things down to a maximum of three to make sure there was ample opportunity for most people to go to meetings. And so we knocked off lower preference or the lower choice preferences that those people had given us. So if you had said, well, this location is a six in terms of my choices, so that one disappeared. And that left you with one, two, or three first choices if you had that many. And we went back through the lists and just took names off this cell or this community. And we went through that process up and down until we came towards the end that we had people were either going to two meetings because that's what they wanted to do, or the one meeting because a couple of people indicated they wanted to go to one meeting. And then some people had indicated, of course, I think the highest number was about 10, but they were only going to go to about three, a couple of locals and one that included some travel. So that was kind of the approach that we used, and then we summarized all that and sent out individual memos. A couple of people were missed, and that's my fault. Emails were sent to my office, and I've gone back, and I found it. I went back twice for years, and I found it the second time. And so we'll pick up on that, but I can't give you your first choice after going through all of this process, Leanne. But nevertheless, we'll find we'll discuss something with you. And then I had Harley, and I've already taken care of those requests because they were fairly easy to deal with. We still have some openings. There are some communities, for some reason, people don't know where they are or don't want to go there, one of the two. And so some of those people some of those communities will have people who said, we'll go anywhere. And so there's a number of people like that. Some of the locations that are very heavy in terms of population. You can take Surrey here, and I think there's 22 or 23 names on here. And so we follow the same kind of principle that we would say all of the number one priorities would go, and I think we even went as far as all of the number two priorities. And then we started doing some selection in terms of getting a green name in there so that we had somebody from a far distance coming to the meeting, and then maybe someone who has to travel, you know, from the middle of the province, and I think Peter might be in the Okanagan somewhere. So that was kind of the process we used for Surrey. And so those people who had Surrey down as the fifth priority, even though that could be their home community, were taken off so that we could kind of keep the size down. This still leaves about 13 or 15 people who have received a letter saying, you know, you're designated as a Surrey representative of the assembly, or an assembly representative for that Surrey meeting. And there's two meetings in Surrey, and the second one doesn't have quite as many names in it, and there's possibilities of moving over to the Monday night, but some people can only do things on the Saturday. So that's kind of the process that we used to get down to the selection that was given to you. I know that's confusing. I don't know if anybody wants to ask any questions. That'll only make it more confusing, but I'll stop for a question or two right now if there's one. Yes, Darlene.
If I happen to be in a particular area through that time when we're doing these hearings, could I come into some of these meetings too?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, if some of you still want to go to a local meeting, but you had it as a very low priority and you'd still like to go, you're all citizens of this province and you can go to any meeting you want, and that's fine. Whether we will see that as an assembly member attendee or not, I might have to discuss that with Jack, and I haven't done that because I've been too busy with the process. But if you want to go to meetings on your own, that's fine. Okay, there's a few other questions that have come up that I don't have the answer for you yet. And one of those is about marketing or promotion of the meetings. A press release was sent out from the communications staff to all of the local papers around the province, and I don't know whether they picked up, as well as the locations for all of the meetings. And all of the information is on the website, so we keep referring people to our website. Information on the public hearing is on the public website, as well as the locations and so on. Some people are aware that the hearings are going to take place. We've received 13 requests for presentations already, and they're from all over the province. The last one, as a matter of fact, came from Lillooet. And so somebody in Lillooet wants to make a presentation to the assembly. So as we start promoting this, I'm sure that we'll have more people interested in coming out. At the next session, the communications department will bring forward a full marketing strategy as to how we want to approach promoting and providing information on the hearings. And hopefully, I keep telling people in the office that we have 160 ambassadors out there that are going to go out and shake the bushes and find people to come to these meetings. So that's it for me at this point, unless there are more questions. One more thing is the presentation. That was also a question. We want to start the hearings out with a presentation, and we'll discuss the content of that presentation somewhere down the road and possibly have it in terms of feedback, too, for the last meeting of March. But essentially we're seeing assembly members who have been designated as the assembly's representatives being somewhat at the front of the room, kind of receiving the presentation from whoever wants to make a presentation. And we also expect to see some dialogue take place between the panel and members of the audience. And so we're still working on that, and we'll bring that back to the assembly certainly in due course. Rob, you had a question?
Some people have asked me if they need to register with you before they go to the open meetings, or whether they can just show up and still address the open meeting in general.
I think it would be useful to know you're coming. I don't recognize all of you out on the street in this room. I kind of can recognize you, but it would be nice to know if you do intend going to the meeting on your own.
No. I meant actually the public was like people were asking about making presentations to the open meetings.
Oh, I think we'll have people registered, and we're going to kind of guarantee them a slot on the agenda, and then anybody else who comes to that meeting can speak and address the assembly. Clearly, it's an open meeting in that respect. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
For the presentations at the public hearings, will there be a limit to the time given to the presentations?
We've indicated that it'll be 10-minute presentation, 10 minutes for questions, and giving some flexibility to the facilitator to maybe extend that time if there's only half a dozen presentations to be made. But that information's on the website. Over here, there's a... Yes.
I've been allocated to go to Quesnel, and yet on the last schedule I have for the public meetings, there's no date for Quesnel. Will this schedule be revised?
Oh, well, that must be a very old form you have. Quesnel I have down for May 11th. Okay, and I think I announced that on the second one. Now, the other change we made was Seashelt. And that's going to be on June the 5th, which is a Saturday. And the reason was is we just couldn't get back to Vancouver so that we can start heading off to Prince George the next morning. And so we thought it would be better to put it onto a Saturday. So we've moved the Seashelt meeting over to Saturday, June the 5th. Now, the last comment, if some of the places you've been assigned just doesn't work for you and I've made an error in judgment, just let us know, and then we'll try to work things out. I have one individual who's already indicated that they just can't go to a meeting that happens to be during the week, but they could go to a Saturday meeting. And I had another member said, well, I can't go to that meeting because I'm going to be out of the country at the time. And so I was able to sort that one out relatively quickly. And we may be able to do more of that if there are problems. But, you know, hopefully the areas that you're going to will provide you with a good experience. So. Yes.
Are there set hours for the meeting?
We're looking for most of the meetings to take place between 6:30 and 9:30 if they happen to be a week meeting, 1:30 and 4:30 if they happen to be a Saturday meeting, with the exception of meetings in the Northeast, where I was advised that people are farming at that time of the year and don't want to come in off the fields too early. So they'll start at about 7 o'clock. And then there were issues about ferry schedules and stuff like that. But I took a look at the ferry schedules, and I don't think there's a conflict there with the possible exception of maybe one location. But eventually we'll get all that information. The stuff that's on the website has all the start times listed on it. So I think the three Northeast questions were the one area, and I don't know whether we did one on the island. Do you remember, Don? No? Okay. Okay, well, we'll see you at the hearings then. Thank you.
Thanks, Leo. Actually, Leo worked 12 hours a day for 2 weeks on this one, all the sheets and charts in his office and everything else. And I kept on poking in, and when I poked my head in, I kind of would like, get away, get out of here, you know. Very pleased to call on Campbell.
Okay, I've been told that I should speak up and loudly because sometimes my voice drops off. So. I've also come to the conclusion that there's a law of the conservation of movement, so Ken has static presentations but moves around the room, and I stay in the same place but the presentations move. So. Okay, I have a topic very different from Ken's. Ken did a wonderful job summarizing a very complicated range of systems, or systems which are maybe the principle simple, but the detail is complicated. I'm taking one system which is not particularly broadly applied, but as you'll see, has characteristics which could be applied in BC and could be applied lots of places. For various reasons, it hasn't been particularly popular. Okay, let's look at the basic principles. Well, the first one is that it's a proportional representation system. It's, as Ken indicated, a way of getting seats to correspond, proportion of seats to correspond with a proportion of votes. But it is a completely different system because it's not based on parties. It's based on trying to sum individual person's preferences. So it's PR is proportional, but it achieves proportionality by adding the preferences of voters for individual candidates. So it's essentially candidate-based. Okay, so big difference. But, of course, to do that, it requires a preferential ballot. Remember when we looked at preferential ballots under AV, alternative vote, and you'll see more of these as time goes by, voters are required to rank candidates. So it's no ticks, no crosses, have to put numbers. Okay. Now, again, as with Ken, the mechanics of counting votes can be complicated, but the principle is pretty simple. Candidates, they're elected from multi-member districts in proportion to the electoral support. Okay, so the idea is that you rank the candidates 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or whatever, and then you go through some sometimes complicated counting procedure, but the idea is to have seats to correspond with a range of opinion in the community. And that makes it an anti-majoritarian. Now, what that simply means is that, say, the plurality majority systems that we looked at really are designed to generate majorities. In plurality, it creates majorities, or both plurality and majorities create systems, create majorities even if there aren't any in the electorate. Whereas this system is designed to represent diversity. To represent diversity rather than simply produce either-or choices. Okay, now a little bit of history is not bad. So, and Ken's mentioned this before, he was saying that PR in the earlier, all those years ago in one of the early weekends, that one of the characteristics of the evolution of electoral systems was that after people got the vote, the franchise, there was then a question, well, how did maybe we can refine the way in which that is translated into seats? And when a large number of people were given the vote, there was a serious worry that minorities would be swamped, that the range of opinion wouldn't be reflected in representative assemblies. So it was a serious worry. And PRSTV was devised by a number of people as a way of permitting individuals and groups to express minority views in the assembly. So its goal is to represent diversity. It's against any system which simply has majority on one hand, minority on the other. Okay, and I want to say this because Farrell kinds of dances around this. You can quote me next week, ask him. But it has an anti-party characteristic. That is, it's designed by concentrating on candidates, as you'll see. It does aim to limit the influence that party has over candidates. Now, as you'll also see, this doesn't always work out that way. But certainly the logic of the system, by giving voters a strong choice of candidates, does tend to reduce the effect that parties have over candidates. Okay, the voters, a choice of which of a party's candidates they prefer. And the other side of that is, of course, is the parties can't guarantee victory to a particular candidate. There are no safe seats under PRSTV. If it's a candidate-based system, then if you vote for candidates, then the party can't guarantee you a safe seat. So anything further from a list system would be hard to imagine. The whole point of a list system is that it guarantees all, except the Finnish system, but almost all PR list systems, parties can guarantee safe seats. And even in our system, the plurality system, if you're in a safe NDP or a safe Liberal seat in the sense that voters voted 60 or 65% for those parties, then that's a safe seat. But in the PRSTV, no, not the case. Each candidate must maintain his or her own personal appeal to the voters. It's a bit more history and context.
This means that candidates may see their major rivals as other candidates in the same party. Okay, so they're not just running against the opposition party's candidates, they're running against their own. So you can have, I mean, the kind of, so Sheila Copps is in this position, fighting for a seat in Hamilton in Ontario. But under, if they were PRSTV in Ontario, or for the Canadian elections, then maybe she wouldn't have to worry too much, because both her and the minister that she thinks is trying to take her seat could get, they're both well known, they might both get elected, but those two candidates would might also be opposed by other Liberal Party candidates who would appeal to Liberal voters, and the Liberal voters would be able to choose which one of the candidates or which ones would be able to get elected. So this means, of course, if the party can't guarantee you a seat, it means that one of the major sanctions that a party has, that's moving you down the list in a PR list system or not endorsing you, that major sanction has gone. Now, I say weakened because once you're elected to Parliament, of course, parliamentary parties still have quite an influence over people's careers. So the discipline that's missing is it weakens the ability of parties to control endorsement of candidates. It doesn't limit their ability to control them once they're elected so much. There I go, speaking quietly at the end. My apologies. Okay, so this explains in part why PRSTV has not been popular with governing parties. It's not been not accepted, or to avoid the double negative, it hasn't been accepted or been adopted very often because the party that adopted it would see its control over candidates reduced. And so if you look at the parts of the world where it has been adopted, it's tend to have been adopted for idiosyncratic reasons, as you'll see. Either that parties hadn't emerged in quite the form they had now, or you've got a new system starting from scratch, or it's for an upper house in a chamber and there was a problem which PRSTV could fix. So it's not that it doesn't have appeal, it's that it has this anti-party flavour. Okay, let's go through Ken's list again. District magnitude, as with any proportional system, it's got to be two, more than two. You can't divide one person without a lot of mess. It's not necessary to have the same district magnitude for every electoral district, as with the PR list. Ireland has district magnitudes, it's the Republic of Ireland, 3, 4 and 5, Australian Senate, 6 and 2, or you could say 12, 2 sometimes, but usually 6 and 2, and the West Australian Upper House, 5 and 7. And PRSTV can also be used in at-large elections with a district magnitude of 21. That's New South Wales Upper House. But it makes for a very, very long ballot paper. The last one was the size of a kind of tablecloth. So, although, as you'll see, there are ways of making that choice much simpler than it might first look. Ballot structure. Voters must use a preferential ballot, so you know all about that. Voters must rank the candidates. Voters can be required to express preferences for one or more, or for the number of vacancies that exist in the district, or for all candidates. And the design of the ballot paper is important. And STV is probably more important than most. Now, you've got a version of this elsewhere, but I've been waiting to use this pointer, and now's the time. So what I've got done here is use Ken's list of candidates and parties. And the one on the left is simply, I've got, there are three parties and an independent. They've each got five candidates, and they're running for a district with five members to be elected. And at the top there, this one here, someone has gone down. You'll notice that the parties are not alphabetically arranged, but the candidates are. And someone has gone down the ballot 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now, in Australia, that's called a donkey vote. Now, it could be that they actually did prefer the candidates in that order. But a lot of voters, depending on... a lot of candidates fear that a significant number of voters do that, and therefore they are a little worried about the rank order. They don't like alphabet. Ken tells me, who's the expert on Ireland, that there's a hugely disproportionate number of people's names starting with A's and B's in the first half of the alphabet in the Irish Parliament, and that people who were called O'Donnell and O'Connell have lost the O on the grounds that it gives them that little edge. Okay, so if we go to the N one, that's this one over here, this one over here, this is assuming that the person did actually want to vote for Angela, Harley, Julie, Nick and Paul in that order. Okay, so what they've got to do there is they have to, because the names are randomly assigned, they have to actively look for the names within the party groups and rank them in that order. And so what about the middle one? Well, the middle one is the parties are arranged in alphabetical order, blue, gold, red, independents, of course, before red, but the candidates are still alphabetically arranged. The reason I mention this is if you look at Julie, on the ballot, if Julie here is someone who this voter definitely wanted to vote for, so Julie is number one, but she really hadn't have too much preference other than Julie. So Nick gets her second preference, and then Paul. And so some people have said that this is wicked because Nick gets a second preference and he doesn't deserve it because he just happened to be underneath a popular candidate. And so there are some schemes to shuffle the ballots so that each ballot is slightly different from the next. It's called, and I mentioned in the outline there, something called Robson rotation, where the ballots are different. Now, what I should point out here, of course, is you don't have to group the candidates by party. You can have them just alphabetical, and then you can pick your five. If you are in Ireland, you only have to vote for one candidate. You can vote for more parties, more candidates, but you only have to vote for one. And in Australia, you have to vote, except Tasmania, you have to vote for all of the candidates. So you'd have to go right the way down to the bottom. Anyway, the point is not so much the detail here, but the fact that how you arrange the ballot, if it's an ordinal ballot, if you have to rank candidates, the design of the ballot is not a trivial matter. It's important. Actually, it's important even in plurality systems, whether you're on top. So it's supposed to be worth about 2%. Okay, the dreaded formula. PRSTV is a quota preferential system. So candidates are elected as they gain a quota of votes. And the most common one is the Droop quota, after a person whose name was indeed Dr. Droop. And the quota is the total valid votes in the district, whatever the district magnitude is, divided by the number of seats to be filled plus one, and the whole lot plus one vote. Now you might say, why on earth do you have to go to that? And you can read the description in the printed handout, but the simple answer is, let's suppose the district magnitude is five. Five people can get a five, and only five people can get a fifth of the vote. Six people can get a sixth of the vote. But only five people can get a sixth of the vote plus one vote. Because the last sixth, of course, is minus five votes. So that's the least number of votes you have to have to be sure of getting elected. Think about it. Okay. So that means that if you can get 16.7% of the vote under that quota, you get elected. Now, this is the complicated bit because people say, well, the trouble with STV is that the counting is complicated. It is in a way. It is in a way. But the principle is clear. The idea is you don't want to waste. You want to try and sum the preferences as fairly as you can. First thing you do is you count the ones, as you do with AV. And if a candidate gets a quota on the first preferences, the candidate's elected. If the candidate has more than a quota, the surplus is transferred. This is where it gets tricky. You look for the second preferences, and then you transfer them to other candidates. Now, the idea is that if you vote for a popular candidate, your vote shouldn't be wasted. Just because it's a very popular candidate, doesn't just because you've voted for Julie or whatever, that you should have... That should float on to someone else. And so that's why you distribute the surplus. Okay, once there are no more surplus votes, you then start crossing off the least successful candidates, and their votes are transferred at full value because, of course, they haven't elected anybody yet. So there's this kind of waterfall effect. Someone's elected, the surplus is distributed, maybe someone else is elected on the surplus, then they distribute their surplus, and then... when there's no more surplus, then you start crossing people off. Exclusion, exclusion, surplus, and so on. Quite simple. Okay. So that's the process. Distribution of surplus until you get down there. So an animated... we'll go back to our South Australian one. Again, because I'm sorry for the late delivery of the outlines. I was all prepared, but I just forgot to give them out. And I hadn't checked whether this is working, so let's see if it does. It basically is the same little person for the state, the electoral office, the state electoral office of South Australia, and it allocates, it shows how the various candidates get the surpluses distributed. So we shall pass over that. Okay. Variations in the system. District magnitude is the most common variation. That means you can change the size or the number of people that are elected from each district. And what it means is if you have a district magnitude of less than 5, then proportionality tends to drop off. It was because it's the ratio of votes to seats. The more seats you have, the more accurate the proportionality can be. Once you get down to... one or two, or to two, then of course the quota is only a third, so basically it's a choice between two large parties. So before the proportionality kicks in at five and or three and four, and then it takes off at five and it gets quite proportional as you go above that. Okay, variations can also occur in the number of preferences, as I mentioned before. Sometimes you may have to vote, you just fill in one for the Irish system. As many candidates as there are vacancies in Tasmania, or all of them if it's in the Australian Senate. Ballot design is important, and many variations are possible. Even circular ones were considered in South Australia, in Tasmania at one stage. So Australian Senate elections, instead of numbering all the squares, voters are urged by parties to make a single party choice. And I've given you that huge ballot, which is in the envelope, which I'll talk about a bit later on. That is an Australian Senate ballot. And so what it does is to say either you vote easily below the above the line just by put a one next to a party, or you've got to fill in all the squares below the line. And you can guess which most Australians do. Most of them choose, unfortunately. I tell my students they fail the course if they vote, or I told my students they fail the course if I found them voting below the line or above the line. But 90% of Australians vote by ticking the box, which of course changes the whole logic of the system. It looks like a PRSTV. It's counted like a PRSTV system, so it's still an STV count, but really it's a choice driven by parties. Okay, I've got three examples. I've got Ireland, Tasmania, and the Australian Senate. And each of them demonstrate different things. Now, Ken is the expert on Ireland, so he was very forbearing to let me do this. Okay, it's used STV for its lower house since the Republic of Ireland was formed. Its first election in 1922. District magnitudes are now between 3 and 5 in a house of 166 members, or TDs as they're called. So Irish politics is brokerage politics. By that means that basically the success of a politician or a government is required or is measured by the groups and locations and areas and whatever that feel happy with the services that the government have provided for them. Log rolling is another expression that it's important that, not, in other words, the opposite would be ideological politics. If you've got very strong beliefs of the view of the way, so programmatic politics, you've got a whole program to change society, given on a given philosophical commitment, that's ideological politics. If politics is about dealing with problems as they occur and putting oil on squeaky wheels, that's brokerage politics. Local issues are as important as national ones, and successful candidates must build a local support base. Now, there's been only one big party, Fianna Fáil, that has been in a position to get a majority of seats on its own. Please note, there is a big party using a proportional system that has been able to get a majority of seats on its own. And for much of a significant minority of the period, since 1922, there have been majority one-party single-party governments. Fine Gael and the smaller Labour Party have formed governing coalitions, and most governments have lasted several years. Obviously, there's the odd period, like 1952-53 here, when the system has a little tremor, spits the dummy, jumps up and down, but by and large, governments have lasted a significant number of years. And that's important because normally that's not associated with proportional systems. Now, there have been two attempts by governments to change the electoral system to single-member districts, and guess what party was keen on that? The biggest party. The biggest party said, why do we have to go through this business? Why can't we have a nice, simple plurality system that allows us to regulate our candidates more evenly and give us a bonus when we get elected? And both times, the voters have turned it down, the second time with quite a thumping majority. The locals like it. Now, I've got another fine website, which you won't be able to see, but in spite of the name, it's got nothing to do with polar bears. I still have yet to find out why it's called that. But it is a website which gives the actual results for the last four or five Irish national general elections. And it's quite a cunning system. It shows how the count goes. It shows surpluses being distributed. It shows then candidates being excluded, and then final numbers of candidates being elected. So I commend that to you. But as a consolation prize, in your breakout sessions, you will be able to look at an example for the electoral district of Meath, which is in your ballot package, which on one side has the figures showing the count, and on the other side has a commentary by Ken on how the process goes. So it looks at a single district and shows how the preferences flow. And it's quite interesting. Some candidates are quite can discipline their supporters and the voters. As one gets a surplus, those surplus votes flow to another candidate of the same party. But other candidates, the surpluses flow all over the place. So the voters can follow the party line if they wish, or they can give their second and subsequent preferences to candidates of other parties. Tasmania. I should say I lived in Tasmania for a while. It's the only state in the Australian Federation to have PRSDV for its lower house. the Australian Capital Territory also has PRSTV, but the Australian Capital Territory is not a state. Tasmania is a heart-shaped island off the southern coast of Australia. Now, it adopted PRSTV in 1909, before the current party system had emerged. And it was very dependent on the persuasive characteristics of a guy called Ingalls Clark. In fact, they call the system in Tasmania the Hare-Clark system, after him. So it wasn't adopted because of any party campaign. It was a result of an expression of a belief in the time that there were genuine advantages in PRSTV if you were designing a representative assembly. And once it's there, of course, it became hard to unpick. Now, the Tasmanian House of Assembly has been based on five electoral districts ever since 1909. And they've all been the same at any one time, but they varied. Originally, they were six, then they were seven, and now they're five. So the assembly's actually got smaller. Now, that's partly because one of Tasmania's major exports has been people, so the population hasn't increased very much since 1909, only about 100,000. But also because the parliamentarians voted themselves recently a huge rise, and there was a complete outrage. It was a bit like the Paul Martin response to the scandals in current funding scandals in Quebec. There was a genuine and heartfelt uprising, and in order to show that they were repentant, they reduced the size of the parliament. They didn't reduce their salaries, but they... And that happened to suit the government of the day because it meant that the system became less proportional and a rather small, irritating Green Party had its representation reduced. But that's not the argument they used, of course. It was in the national interest to reduce. Okay. You know the story. Now, this is a Tasmanian ballot paper, and you have one which I handed out. And I'm giving... reason why it's keen you look at it, because it's a real... I should say, Ken was rather surprised that I stressed Tasmania. He said, why not Ireland? Because he knows a lot about Ireland, and Ireland is kind of bigger than Tasmania, and people know where Ireland is, and they don't know where Tasmania is. And they think of Disney and Tasmanian devils. But the reason is because Tasmania has a party system which is more like BC than... the Irish one. The Irish one, Irish party system, has got a lot to do with religion and history and region and all kinds of things. Whereas Tasmania, on the face of it, looks like a two-party system. That's why candidates are grouped in parties. And so what you have to do is you fill in the squares. Don't say my thing's not working. This is a bad day. It is working. It's just my aim. Okay. Okay, so you have to fill in. It is flashing. Look at that. It must be me. Okay, so I'm not using the pointer. Another one. Okay. Yes. This is good. Girl Leo. All right, so the idea is you fill in, you vote, you can vote down the list if you want. You can vote down one of these lists, 1, 2, 3, 4. And don't forget, these names are on the ballot paper, not only randomly, random order, but each candidate has a choice of, there's a computer program which gives each candidate an equal share of first, second, and last in the party list. Okay, so... they're all stirred up. So, for example, Hodgman, who is a notorious person, just because you're underneath on the ballot, Hodgman, Stephen here, doesn't mean that he gets an added bonus. So, But you only have to fill in as many vacancies, as many squares as there are vacancies, so you only have to fill in five, and you don't have to follow the party list. You can go vote crossways, diagonal, whatever it is. Okay. I should say the story of getting that ballot, this was not my week. I arranged for a ballot to be delivered by FedEx, and it took a week and a half. So, all right, Tasmania, although it's small, twice the size of Vancouver Island, it's strongly regionalised, with local issues dominating. Our politics has been dominated by two large parties, but they have been independents and a Green Party. So what I've got here is a chart of the vote shares of the two biggest parties and all the rest. Okay? STV started just after all the turmoil. So, maybe 1909 is about there. Okay, 1909. Okay. Notice it's before the Labour Party and the Liberal Party had really got going as the two major parties. So that's vote share. That's the share of votes. And you see that in spite of a proportional system, the electoral system has been dominated by these two large parties. So even though it's STV proportional, two large parties have continued. This is seats, okay? Votes, seats. Now, notice before STV, wildly disproportional. After STV, a much more even balance. Okay, pre-STV, after STV. And you can see that there have been minor players, but they've been relatively small until recently. And what's happening now, as you can see this crash in the blue line, is one party has got a very comfortable majority, but the Liberal Party is in serious trouble. So it may be displaced or it may bounce back. I should say, some people said to me, well, why, how can that be? And the answer is, of course, that the parties are not quite parties like other Australian parties, even though they have the same name, because the members of the party have to be sensitive to regional, local concerns. So they need both a personal characteristic as well as party endorsement. So candidates must have a strong constituency support as well as being endorsed, chosen by the party. Candidates, competition between each. See, of that list of seven we saw, or only two or three are going to be chosen. So there's a lot of competition within those lists. Most governments have been single-party governments, and it had a Labor Party government from 1937 until 1969. So that's too much stability, I think, even for people who like stable government. And it has several rules which limit party control of candidates. So they're grouped by party, but the ordering is randomised, and the parties are precluded from advertising a party preferred order. So it's an offence to say, vote Fred, Joanna, whatever. So each candidate says, vote for me and then other Liberal Party candidates in order of your preference. So there is a major attempt to limit party control. All right, let's go to the other extreme. Now, the Australian Senate is the upper house of the National Parliament. There are 19 million people in Australia, so there are 19 million voters minus people under age, non-citizens, whatever. There's six states and two territories. They vote, each state and each district, each territory votes as a single electoral district. And half the senators, there are 12 senators from each state, half retiring every 3 years. So the district magnitude is six for the states and two for the territories. The territories don't rotate, they're always chosen. Always two. So there are 76 senators. Now it was adopted in 1949, partly for partisan gain, in the short term partisan gain I should have said, and partly to solve a long running problem with the composition of the Senate. There were violent changes in the party composition of the Senate. And for various reasons, there was some kind of cross-party support for introducing proportional representation. And the only system that would fly was PRSTV. Now, the Senate, as I said, is an interesting example of how PR can be manipulated to operate like a list system. So it looks like a PRSTV, but it operates like a list system. Up until 1983, it was just like the Tasmanian ballot. Maybe a bit longer, but much the same. But after 1983, from 1984 on, or I should say, and what the voters were confronted with was a very difficult task. There were no party names on the ballot. So what the parties said to the voters was, here is a list with 41 names, grouped by A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. You don't know how to vote, do you? Because you don't know most of these candidates. So here is a how to vote card. Labour Party vote card, Liberal Party vote card, whatever it is. Just copy the numbers from your how to vote card onto the ballot. Don't think about it. It's okay. Just go down the list just as we tell you and everything will be fine. And so the how to vote card became a very important component of voting. And it was so successful that no candidate was ever elected other than in the party preferred order. But just to make assurance doubly sure, in 1984, they did with the ballot, as you have in your package, a big line which says just vote one for any party and we'll fill in all the squares for you. Don't think about it. Don't worry about filling all those squares. Just vote the party list and we'll fill in all the squares for you in our party preferred order. Now, this has all kinds of other effects. It enables parties to do deals about preferences. But the important thing is that it tends to negate the very purpose for which PRSTV was set up. So it's not a pretty story if you're interested in PRSTV. Now, the main thing is it provides a very strong contrast with Ireland and Tasmania, where the party preferred order is not an issue in Ireland. Ken tells me that it would be unthinkable to the party names are on the ballot, but unthinkable to group candidates in party groups. They're simply listed on the ballot alphabetically. It's up to the voter to pick the candidate and the party which he or she wants to vote for and rank the candidates accordingly. So even grouping candidates by party is regarded as just not appropriate. Or Tasmania, where yes, you can group them by party, but any attempt by the party to control the rank order of the candidates, a party preferred order, is actively discouraged by randomizing the names on the ballot and then by preventing parties from handing out literature to tell you how to fill in the squares. Now, I say that when you look at that ballot, in that Australian ballot, you'll find there are all kinds of other strange things on it. There's a taxi group, and there's a family law group. And so what's happened is that, in many ways, the upper house elections have been used as campaigns for interest groups to publicise their issue. So it hasn't happened in Ireland or Tasmania. So if you change the system, you may have other unintended effects. If you force people to fill in the squares, you may create unintended effects. That's true of all electoral systems, but particularly that one. Again, contrast with Tasmania, with Ireland and Tasmania. Okay, what about the evaluation? We'll have plenty of time, seeing as there's no movies, there's plenty of time for questions at the end. Evaluation. Impact on the operation of government. Well, stable and effective government, moderate. I say moderate because if it leads to coalition government, then they're likely to be slightly less long-lived than single-party majority governments, but it depends where you are. The logic of it would be that you would have more coalitions, but in the few examples, particularly Tasmania and Tasmania and Ireland, there have been long periods of super stable, well, certainly stable government. but let's be generous, say moderate. Electoral accountability is good for both governments and candidates. Parliamentary check on government is moderate, because although the candidates are freed from a certain degree of party control as candidates, they can be subject to parliamentary party discipline. You know, the enticements. Do you want to be a minister? If you want to be a minister, then you have to toe the line. And premiers and prime ministers have a long list of goodies to hand out to reward members of parliament if they toe the line, and ways of punishing members who don't. So if the government can do that, then the ability of parliament to check the executive is to that extent limited. Monitoring elected representatives is good, even excellent, because you can really pick out the ones you like or you don't like, even within the party. Fair representation, good for parties, not necessarily for groups. There's no party bureaucracy to say we've got to have a certain proportion of women or whatever. So slightly more, but it's dependent on candidate selection more than a central party bureaucracy. Democratic party is good, although when I was doing this, it was difficult to know what one means by a democratic party. If you mean a party whose processes are open, then the answer is, well, yes and no. It's certainly very good in terms of the control of the candidates. But how you get on the list, of course, in the first place, may be a matter for is a party choice. So, but I thought the control that voters exercise over the choice of candidates, the election of candidates, made it good rather than moderate. Impact on voters, choice of voter, good. Choice party and candidate. Identifiable representation, good. Encouragement to participate, moderate. Just slightly better than, although there are so few cases it's hard to generalize. But it's a PR system, so we assume that it is likely to have some of the benefits that Andre Blais talked about. Identifiable representation is good, and equality of the vote is good, although there should be a little kind of question mark there. It assumes that the districts are allocated in proportion to population. Because, of course, if you draw the boundaries to have 10,000 people in one electoral district with a DM of 5 and 5,000 people in another district with a magnitude of 5, then, of course, the people in the second group have twice as much voting power. So it's... Once you start drawing boundaries under any system, then you may affect the quality of the vote. But in terms of turning votes into seats within any district, then it's pretty good. Okay, its strengths. It gives the benefit of proportion representation, close match between seat chairs and vote chairs. That's what PR is designed to do. Smaller parties have a better chance of gaining representation. So if you can get more than the quota, you've got 5 member districts, if you can get more than 16.7% of the vote, then you're elected. Note, it doesn't have to be 16.7% of the first preference vote. It can be 16.7% of any votes which are transferred to you and your original ones. So, for example, in the Australian Senate, the small parties that are elected typically never get a quota of first preferences. They depend, although the word feed-off is used by the people who run the large parties, preferences allocated from the larger parties. But it means that small parties do have a much better chance of getting representation than under a plurality majority system. It gives the voter the opportunity to vote for individual candidates as well as parties, and to choose among candidates both between parties and within parties. And it permits candidates to be elected who appeal to a particular constituency. It's, and that can be geographical or some other one. And apple growers or barbed wire collectors or whatever, as well as geographical areas. So you can, a member can cultivate a particular constituency and get herself or himself elected. We'll come back to that when we get to BC. And it doesn't discriminate against independent candidates. Now, independent candidates are an interesting phenomenon. There's not many of them around. But, if you like, they are an expression of a dissatisfaction with all parties. And, of course, you can't have a party list system, can't elect independents. You have to form yourself into a group. If you look at that Tasmanian ballot I gave you, you'll notice there's a little group at the end called E. And there's a footnote that says these two people agreed to be listed together. They're basically independents who agreed to run on an independent ticket. But, of course, they could have been ungrouped and been just out on right field. Okay, assessment weaknesses. It requires a preferential ballot, which is more complicated for voters than a categorical choice. Note, if Tasmanians can do it, ... Okay. They've been doing it since 1909. Okay, but it is certainly more complicated than a simple tick or cross. There's no single geographically defined local member. So it's not like a plurality or a majority system with a DM of one. And it is more likely to produce coalition governments than plurality or majority systems. So if you don't like majority systems, if you don't like coalition governments, then PRSTV, that's a strike against it. If it represents minor parties fairly or in proportion to their vote and they get 10% of the vote, the chances are you're going to have a coalition sooner or later. It may take 20, 30 years, as in Tasmania, but it will happen sooner or later. It may encourage regional and or sectional politics and brokerage politics rather than politics based on province-wide issues. Now, again, it depends whether this is a strength or a weakness. It depends on your taste for politics. If you like majoritarian, programmatic politics, the government gets in there and has a plan. Well, I'm always suspicious of government plans, but let's say it has a plan and it's going to carry it out, you won't. That is a major problem because it's difficult to, if you have a coalition, it's difficult to get people to agree to follow that. And if the members of parliament themselves are acutely aware of the costs and benefits of that plan on their local region, then it may be difficult to persuade your supporters to back that. Again, whether this is good or bad, it depends which side of the fence you're on. But it certainly is an issue in the old-fashioned sense. Issue now seems to mean problem. I mean it an issue meaning an item for consideration. Now, I have issues. You know, it's okay. I have an issue with the internet connection. Yes, okay. It has the potential to weaken party control of candidates and members of parliament. Again, it's a matter of which side, whether you think that's good or bad. But it certainly means that a member can threaten to, in Tasmania on occasion, can threaten to be an independent. It hasn't happened very often. It does mean that the very fact of that threat, the fact that their personality is as important as their party endorsement, means that parties are to that extent more limited in their choice of candidates. And as is graphically demonstrated by the Senate, PRSTV can be altered by other electoral rules, such as ballot design and campaigning rules. It makes a very big difference. What about in BC? Well, voters outside the mainland would find themselves in ridings of at least three times or five times bigger than at present if you went to a DM of district magnitude of three or five. Now, it's true that PRSTV would permit candidates with strong local support to get elected. But it means that the candidates and the parties and the voters would have to change the way they thought about how they chose candidates and how they campaigned for them and how they voted for them. So it's not that STV precludes local candidates, but you have to pick them in a slightly different way. Certainly there is no neat geographical area which you say that's my seat or your seat. So it would involve a change of campaigning and parties and voters. Competition between candidates would require voters and parties to adjust their campaigns, and they would have to become more personalised. It would be a different way, a different kind of campaigning. Whether it would be more fun or not is a matter of taste, but it certainly would be different. And voters would have to learn to use a preferential ballot. And this is no small thing, although I make light of it. The changeover to preferential ballot, you would have to accept there would be a much higher informal rate of informal voting, people not filling in the squares appropriate, spoil ballots than usually be the case. I should say that's why Tasmanians and voters in Australian elections force voters to fill in a minimum number of squares, 5 or maybe all of them, because the designers of the system said, well, we know we're going to lose ballots that are invalid, that are spoiled. But on the other hand, if we don't make people fill out a fair number of the squares, we're not going to have enough preferences perhaps later down. The counting process may be impaired, may be seen to be not fair if the last candidate elected does so only with a very small share of the vote. That's really not really relevant, but that was a thought. I should return. Voters, so if you change to preferential ballots, it does mean that you have to rank them. But on the other hand, it seemed to work pretty satisfactorily in BC. Okay, questions?
Shoni.
I have two questions and a request for clarification. First of all, in what's considered a surplus when they're redistributing, if, say, 100 votes are needed to get a seat and there's 150, so 50 surplus, which 50 get their second choice counted? Is it, did the first 100 stay with first and then the next 50 move on?
That's a wonderful question. Books have been written on this topic. The short answer is there are two ways to go. One way is to just take a random 50 and allocate the second preferences of those ballots. Problem, if you took another 50, the preferences might be different. The random selection is the one they use in Ireland. Yes, Ken? What have you got? Yes, okay. Yeah, the Irish, there you know, the Lord's there, he will direct where the preferences go. Okay. Tasmania and Australia in general has less faith. And so what it does, it counts all those 150 preferences and transfers them on a reduced rate, second preferences, a thing called a transfer value.
So it's like two-thirds.
Yes, so if you have, actually given the time, it was good that we couldn't run those things because they'd take a while, but if you have a time to look at the South Australian example, that's the system they use, and it shows how they calculate the transfer value and what happens. But yes, it is a question.
And my second question is, when you're talking about voting above the line, what happens when you have 90% of the people voting above the line and you have a party list of preferences predetermined? What happens to the 10% who vote their preferences? How do you
Well, the fiction under that system is that they're all filled in by each individual person. So the ballots look the same whether they're filled in by the party or the individual.
So the 90% are filled in by the party.
Exactly.
Okay.
Or they're lodged, they have to lodge a schedule with the party, with the Electoral Commission, a week or so before the election.
Okay.
Tannis, to your right.
Yes.
I'm just wondering what the deal is with voters and having problems with ballots and preferential. You know, you seem to be saying that if there's an easier choice, voters would choose an easier kind of balloting system. And what are your conclusions of why voters seem to prefer simpler ballot systems?
Well, the voters are not often asked that question, but we're talking about two things. The design of the ballot is a matter for governments, and they are not neutral people in this. But it, unfortunately, with human nature, is that people tend to do the minimum required. So there's a lower threshold for a tick or a cross than it is for a number. Some people get tired. You know, you get down to four, and then you fall asleep. So you Does that answer the question? It's what you're used to. So.
Well, I'm just wondering if there's some education that needs to happen there, or you know what we would need to do in order to, because we have to think about this if we are going to introduce a new ballot. What's the prep work that needs to happen, or are there some proven kind of educational approaches, or, you know, just to kind of bring people along and, you know, hope that they won't get tired after number four?
I'm sure there'd be a campaign. Most people, I think, a large majority would realize what was going on, but people would make mistakes, and the rate of spoiled ballots on the first time would be quite high, might be 5%, 6%, 7%. But you just keep... It might always be 3% or 4%. It may be twice the size it is now, but that's the price of having a system which provides more information. What you're doing is you're giving much more information on the ballot than you do with a simple cross or a tick.
We have time for George, Rob, and then Susan.
Shawnee asked the same question as I did on her first question. Thank you.
Yes, I was just wondering, at lunch I was reading some information about the none of the above thought as to people might not want to vote for any of these. Would there be something, or couldn't you incorporate something like that into, I guess you would call it below the line instead of above the line? Has that ever been tried at all?
Well, that's what Ken's talking about tomorrow morning. He includes in mixed systems, because that's a kind of different system, because it implies randomness, but it wouldn't really work with STV. On the whole point is for people to express preferences that they have, if they of the choices they give. Yes.
Susan.
Campbell.
Yes.
I just wanted to. Did you say you lived in Tasmania for a while?
I did. Both my children were born there.
Okay. What happened to you here today? A couple times, the Tasmanian devil must have possessed you.
Yes. Actually, they're very unpleasant animals. They're not like the Disney thing at all. They eat roadkill.
I realize that.
Was there one more? That was it. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, one right here.
Campbell, I'm just looking at one of the slides that you had up there, and it was about Ireland. Are the regional demographics of Ireland similar to the province of BC in terms of we have areas of Ireland that are quite dispersed in population and areas that are quite concentrated? Is it similar or is it quite a bit different than BC?
That's a question for Ken, but I think the answer is, unless he jumps up and says that, yes, there are differences. There's Dublin, there are bits on the west coast which are pretty dispersed, but it's much smaller than BC. So I doubt whether there are any areas that are quite as dispersed as BC. Fair enough, Ken?
The reason why I ask that is because I'm trying to draw the comparison between Ireland and British Columbia for the sake of trying to make a decision here. And if it's, you know, if it's working in Ireland, would it work here? The regional demographics, the population and the area of our province are definitely going to play a part in this.
The west coast of Ireland has areas where there are Irish speakers, the so-called Gaeltacht, and they have very different kind of connections to the rest of the country. But it's a country with one big dominant city in one corner of the country and a vast sprawling rural population. The distances aren't anywhere near the same, of the same order, and so that a multi-member district wouldn't have to cover the same kind of kind of territory. And there are significant population differences in terms of space.
So I'll follow that up with then, Campbell. What about Tasmania? Are the regional demographics, again, similar to the province of BC or different?
They're strongly regionalized because there's not the same concentration in a large capital city. But there are areas that are quite wilderness type. But again, it's smaller. It's twice the size of Vancouver Island. So the distances are much, much less.
Just trying to get to our discussion groups at 1:45. It's been a kind of a request by popular demand almost. Let's get into our discussion groups earlier. So I'm just passing on what members tell me. Campbell, thank you very much.